This podcast represents the views of the hosts and not the University of Texas at Austin.
This is Policy on Purpose, a podcast produced by the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We take you behind the scenes of policy with people who are shaping and have helped shape it. For more, visit lbj.utexas.edu/podcast. This month on the podcast, we're sharing a four-part series on our symposium, Policy, Leadership, and the Age of AI, which was hosted at the Bass Lecture Hall on October 1st, 2024. As part of UT's 2024 initiative, The Year of AI, we brought together public, private, and academic leaders for crucial discussions on the ethical dimensions of AI technologies and public policy in its ever-evolving landscape. Our fourth and final episode of the series covers the fifth panel of the day, AI in National Security Policy. This panel explores the national security implications of AI, including the potential innovation around AI for national defense. They also consider the laws and ethics of deploying AI systems in armed conflict. It was hosted by Adam Klein, director of the Strauss Center for International Security and Law.
Thank you all for coming today. This is one of those topics that has been a source of fascination for people going all the way back to the 1990s and the Terminator movies. When is artificial intelligence going to pick up weapons and start firing, hopefully not at us? And it's getting closer. And the question for today's panel is, how fast is that happening? What safeguards and constraints are there? Is this going to be a good or bad thing for national security? How should we think about this as citizens, as Americans, as people committed to defending this country and to a more secure and hopefully, ideally, peaceful world? We have a brilliant and insightful group of thinkers here today from a very constructive range of professional backgrounds. All of them have served or currently serve in some capacity in the U.S. military. They're all deeply thoughtful people, but we have a representative from industry and really from the cutting edge of industry and the uses of AI in the security space, from the military in Colonel Ford, one of the brightest thinkers about the legal and ethical implications of fielding these technologies for military purposes, and then Michael Dennis, an academic newly minted here at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, someone we're delighted to have who has thought very, very deeply about the implications of technology for different variants of armed conflicts, irregular warfare, and the multifarious ways that people attempt to resolve their disputes, shall we say, in this 21st century. So I'll very briefly give some biographical details on our panelists, and then each panelist will give a brief opening statement, followed by some questions from me, and then hopefully, and we're very excited about this, questions from you to hear what you all are thinking as citizens. I see many experts as well about this dynamic area of technology that will affect us all. Starting on my left, your right, Professor Michael Dennis of the LBJ School of Public Affairs. Before joining us here at the University of Texas at Austin, Dr. Dennis served as Chief of Intelligence Operations and, perhaps more relevantly, Chief of Strategic Futures at U.S. Army Futures Command, which is a four-star Army command here in Austin, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. He's also served in other roles in the intelligence community in the U.S. government, going all the way back to being a U.S. Marine Corps rifleman who has deployed overseas in support of various operations in Africa and elsewhere. He holds a bachelor's degree and a PhD in government from the University of Texas at Austin. That's really all the qualification he needs, so I'll leave it there. Colonel Chris Ford is the staff judge advocate at U.S. Army Futures Command, which effectively means that he's the general counsel of U.S. Army Futures Command. And I will also say someone that I've had the pleasure in my role as head of the Strauss Center of working very closely with on some of these fascinating issues over the past couple years. He has held many other senior legal roles in the U.S. Army. And has deployed overseas to Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and also to the Philippines in support of post-9/11 U.S. operations in support of counterterrorism in the Philippines. And lastly, here on my left, we have Morgan Hitzig, who is a senior fellow with the Strauss Center in our program on technology, security, and global affairs. And for purposes of today's panel, also an investor at the venture capital firm Venrock, where she focuses on technology companies that deal with the public sector, especially in national security, public safety, and protecting critical infrastructure. Previously, she was head of growth and strategy at a company called Peregrine Technologies, which is a data integration platform for state and local public safety, and has also been a senior official at a very interesting company called Dataminr, which perhaps we'll talk a bit about in the discussions on the use of AI for open source intelligence. Morgan's a native New Yorker, and so therefore she's very proud, I'm sure, to have served as a senior analyst for New York's finest, the NYPD. Shout out to Joe McGuire, another native New Yorker there. And she was an analyst in the NYPD Counterterrorism Bureau after 9/11, where she worked on a broad range of terrorism and cyber issues. And of course, for those of you who don't know, after 9/11, the NYPD spun up one of the world's largest counterterrorism operations, far larger than that of most nation states, and a very sophisticated intelligence unit as well. So Morgan has insight on both the state, local, and federal level of the use of advanced technologies for counterterrorism. Why don't we start with you, Morgan?
Sure. Delighted to be here. So Adam asked to cover, at least from the outset, a couple of different AI applications that I've seen over my time on the CT side and the Intel community as well. I'm a Navy Reserve Intel officer, still supporting special operations. And I think there are a couple of places that I would start. I would say first, really orienting on the biggest volume-related challenges, I would say. The one of the key trends that we're seeing within Intel, and I'm looking forward to hearing what other folks on the panel have to say, is I actually think the future of intelligence is data science. So as we look at every sensor, every data source, every threat potential, all of those different streams that come into a central location as an intelligence professional, whether you're at the state or local level, at the federal level, or in the military, it really becomes a data science challenge. I think the DoD is doing increasingly good job, and I think thanks in large part to what some of the work that Army Futures has done in helping Department of Defense personnel actually learn what does AI mean and what does AI mean for my job in particular. Things like a partnership with MIT through the Horizons platform and several other key initiatives that are really focused in on giving service members tools they need around AI. I'd also talk about some of the other areas I'd look to explore as we continue the conversation are how the DoD is becoming much more software defined, and I think AI is at the heart of that. I think for every new technology area that I look at from a venture capital perspective, even on the kind of hard tech platform side, it's all AI enabled. So AI is the backbone of what's a good Austin-based company? Even like a Saronic, which is a Austin-based company that just had a $1 billion valuation. Everything they are doing, at least at the heart of that platform, is AI enabled. So lots to talk about there in a whole host of ways, from modeling and sim to hardware and everything in between.
Just to quickly intervene, can you explain, you mentioned Saronic, can you explain what their platform is? It's boats, but can you elaborate? And how does AI fit into that? And then another thing to follow up on is software defined, another term you threw out there. Can you explain what that means to everyone?
Yeah, for sure. So Saronic, it was an example just because it's top of mind since they just had a big fundraising round and they're local to Austin. Saronic is one of a growing class of companies that are focused on building out hardware. It's in their particular case, they're an unmanned surface vessel. I think at some point they'll also be kind of subsurface as well. But they're doing something really interesting because they've put onto that vessel a whole host of capability. So they have different modules and different sensors for different types of mission sets that can support everything from enabling U.S. operations in the Indo-Pacific as sort of a extension of a big blue water navy that we would not want to put in harm's way.
Talking about a large ship that could deploy this flotilla of small boats that are going to operate autonomously, that are going to swarm, that are going to come up with their own ways to accomplish a mission, to listen to someone, to spy on someone visually, to blow something up, to serve as scouts, to serve as decoys, whatever the mission may be. And they would accomplish this autonomously working as a team. That's the theory, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And that Saronic's actually a good example to also talk about software-defined, because the Saronic can't do anything without the software that is behind the swarming, is behind the sensor pods, is behind everything Adam just mentioned. And for a long time, the Department of Defense was very much hardware defined. So we talked about it as like perhaps the most hardware defined organization on the planet. We're really good at buying big things, and I'm sure Chris will talk about this a little bit. But now we're starting to transition to how do we actually become much more software defined, although there's a debate to be had as to where we are on that spectrum.
Colonel Ford, over to you.
All right. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Morgan.
So Adam's asked that I talk about the topic of the kind of legal implications of fielding AI in combat operations, and he's given me 5 to 8 minutes to do it. So I think that'll be fine. That's the right amount of time. The international community has been looking at adopting a treaty that relates to AI in combat since 2012, and they haven't defined the term autonomy yet. So, we'll get there. It's glacial. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make 3 broad points about the legality of artificial intelligence in combat operations, and then turn towards some of the more detailed kind of legal aspects of it, just sort of hitting the wave tops, of course, and then I'll be happy to take some follow-on questions or kind of delve into any one of these topics. So the first broad point I'll make is there are no laws in this space, sort of. There are no international or domestic laws that apply specifically to the use of artificial intelligence in combat operations. That's my first broad point. My half point actually is that there are, while there's no laws directly on point, there are laws that are related to how we execute operations in combat, and there are also policies in this space as well. So the Department of Defense is actually kind of world leading in this space, so we have had AI policy on the books since at least 2012. We've had some large-scale DoD studies that preceded that. We've had at least 3 AI strategies since 2018, to include one that just came down in 2023. So there's a lot of policy on the books with respect to the U.S. military, but not so much law. So that's the first kind of point and a half. Second point is this is not about Terminator yet. Right? So there is autonomy as a spectrum, and its use cases also reflect a spectrum running from benign to not benign. Right? And so most of the use cases that the military is looking at right now are on the benign end of the spectrum. How to make decisions better and faster and more informed is sort of where the space is at right now in terms of what the military is looking at. So that's an important consideration. So no direct laws on point, number one. Two, that we have policy but not laws. The second kind of broad point, and this is a spectrum. The third broad point I would make is with respect to any given system that uses artificial intelligence, I cannot tell you in the abstract whether it is legal or not. The legality of the use of that thing depends upon the system and the use of the system in combat operations. So what does it take? What's the analysis? What do we go through when we're looking at these sorts of systems? The threshold question is whether or not the thing that we want to use is a weapon. If it's not a weapon, it's very easy. If it's not a weapon, it's very easy. So we just simply go through an analysis we would use for fielding any other kind of non-kinetic sort of device, whether it's a pen or a book or a truck. There are all the associated issues with AI, so transparency, auditability, bias, emergent behaviors, things of that nature. But from a legal perspective, it doesn't present any interesting issues. If it is a weapon, it becomes a much more complicated analysis. So a weapon is something that's designed to damage or destroy people or objects. And if the thing is a weapon and it has artificial intelligence, it presents a number of kind of complexities that we have to walk through. So broadly speaking, there's a couple categories of weapons that are categorically prohibited. So those are weapons that are inherently indiscriminate, weapons we cannot control, or weapons whose effects could spiral out of control. There are also some specifically banned categories of weapons, such as certain types of mines, blinding lasers, biological weapons. As of right now, AI is not categorically or specifically defined or prohibited a technology. So once you get past the kind of categorical and specific prohibitions, then the question is one of use. What does the object look like on the battlefield? How are you using it? And again, in very broad generalities here, anytime we use any sort of weapon system on the battlefield, we have to do so with distinction. In other words, it has to be able to distinguish combatant from non-combatant and a military objective from a civilian object. It has to be able to operate with proportionality. That is to say, we have to judge the expected military advantage from using this weapon system against the anticipated collateral damage. And we have to be able to take what we refer to as precautions in the attack. That is to say, we have to take reasonable steps to make sure we minimize damage to civilians throughout the pendency of the attack. So distinction, proportionality, and precautions in the attack. Those functions can be and historically have been executed by people, but there is nothing to say from a legal perspective that they couldn't be executed with respect to the software itself, and the software could execute those functions theoretically in the absence of a human. And there's a lot of discussion, I'm sure we'll talk about it, with respect to where the human is relative to those decisions and those that analysis.
Can we have that as a follow-up very quickly? These are especially proportionality. Let's focus on that one. Is this proportional to the military advantage gained when you look at the humanitarian or civilian suffering it's going to cause? Very abstract, very subjective. How valuable is this military objective? How should we weigh these, you know, poor, innocent people who are harmed in this attack against that military objective that may seem very valuable to us but not to others? This is philosopher stuff. We could have students upstairs pondering this and reading ancient venerable treatises to try to figure it out. Does the machine have to be able to do that kind of philosophical reasoning before it can be fielded?
I think if you expect the machine to execute the proportionality analysis, then yes. The challenge of this and in this space...
Do we expect that? Is that the standard in order for the U.S. military to start fielding these systems?
If we expect the thing to operate independently of humans, that is to say humans off the loop, then yes, it would need to be able to execute that sort of judgment independent of a human.
Okay, so hypothetically in a situation where there's a battlefield on the steppes of Eastern Europe, and this is an area where all civilians have fled and Russian tanks are rolling across, and we have something that can use some kind of seeker device to identify something that is pretty damn well sure looks like a Russian tank and swoop in and take the shot on its own, even if it's cut off from communicating to base, we're going to not allow it to do that unless it can run some kind of complex proportionality analysis. Yeah. In advance of that, unless we've developed software that we're going to put into the thing to run this ethical theorizing that we're sufficiently confident will work, say, in an urban counterinsurgency situation where there are people all around, we're not going to field that capability.
Yeah, it's almost like you've thought about this issue, Adam. Proportionality is the singular most difficult, like an illegal hurdle to get over when you're thinking about high-level autonomous weapon systems. And it's, by the way, it's challenged us, I think we may have had this discussion offline at some point in the past, but it's challenged us from a legal community, and that it's forced us to kind of reconcile how we do these analyses as it is, right? Like when you ask a commander, okay, walk me through the proportionality decision you made with respect to that target, it's not a mathematical equation. You're comparing apples to double-decker buses, right? It's a military advantage against collateral damage. That's a very difficult assessment. It's very difficult, it's not impossible to quantify mathematically. The complexity is made more complex, or the issue is made more complex by the factors you suggested, Adam, which is the congested nature of the battlefield, where in the kind of information processing system is the automation occurring? Is it happening at the beginning when you're identifying targets? Is it happening at the end when you're choosing targets? Those are factors that are important. How autonomous that feature is, these are all kind of factors I think that are maybe situation dependent and technology dependent.
And just to add a comment here, one of the things that makes this so interesting is it forces us to reflect on human cognition. Yeah. What is the human doing when the human is running that analysis? How satisfying is the human's explanation? I mean, any one of us could go to ChatGPT, type in the basic factors for this, and it could produce an explanation that, if taken by itself, would look just as plausible as the thing that the human would sit down and type. But for some reason, that probably wouldn't seem viscerally satisfying to most of us. Anyway, I'll leave that. Does anyone want to opine on that?
Yeah, Yeah, just a quick comment. One of the other areas we're really leaning into on the, at least, that was a misplaced we, the Department of Defense is leaning into a little bit. And I've sort of seen from afar is on the modeling and sim side. But when I say that, I mean, in this particular case, more of the wargaming side of like weapons target pairing. How do we do faster decision making around certain issue areas? And AI is a really critical component to it. But I bring it up in this exchange because as you're running simulations over and over and over again, one of the things that's missing, at least in the simulations that I've been a part of, is actually the kind of legal, ethical framework side of it. So wanted to just raise that here.
Thank you. Can you talk to my bosses about that? Can I add one more thing, Adam, to circle back to the philosophical questions here? I think it also kind of raises questions about the nature of human judgment. I mean, in this discussion, the human is considered the gold standard with respect to judgment. And when you ask yourself, you know, what is the role of the human with respect to these systems? Where should they be on the loop? What you're really asking is, what value does the human add? And typically, the answer is judgment. And I think we could have a very long discussion about whether that's value added, when it's value added, when it's diminished, a lot of factors related to that.
Professor Dennis.
All right, great. Well, from the legal, the philosophical, and the theoretical to praxis, how are these things playing out today? And as Adam noted, you know, for a long time, people began to think about how will different technologies play out on the battlefield. And in those conversations, AI was seen as one of the real possible game changers, right? Things that would be tremendously consequential on the battlefields. And today we don't really need to speculate because we can see it, whether you're talking about the battlefields of Ukraine or you're talking about what's going on right now in Gaza. Clearly, adversaries and actors around the world are developing, researching, deploying artificial intelligence in a number of different ways. We've alluded to some of those already on the panel. I wanted to discuss a little bit, as Adam said, some other ways that actors are using these technologies and how we might expect that they'll be used, what impact they have on the battlefield, and then maybe some ideas for how we might think better about the use of these technologies. And so the last comments talking about target acquisition, you know, Israel right now has two systems. One is called Gospel and the other is Lavender, and they are using these for target acquisition. And according to one report, the Lavender system in particular is used not for high-value targets, but for lower, lesser-value targets. And in doing so, there is apparently some type of algorithm, computation that they can use to assess collateral damage, right? And so you have machines making the very sort of determination that we were just talking about. You know, on the other side of the world, Ukraine right now is using AI in a number of different ways, primarily to sift through, right, the reams and reams of data that are being generated by the presence of ubiquitous surveillance. And so they're sifting through that, trying to help speed up, as Colonel Ford said, speed up decision-making, operational decision-making on the battlefield. Of course, they are also using this to inform their drones, whether they're drones for surveillance and reconnaissance, whether they're loitering munitions, whether they're using them to coordinate between different drones to create swarms. And we see, again, just sort of the nature of the battlefield is informing all of these novel adaptations. The Russians, of course, are using AI as well, primarily for drones, but also for cyber and information, deep attacks. And it's not just these state-based actors that we have to be concerned about. It's also non-state actors. And here, talking about groups, you know, everything from terrorists to transnational criminal organizations, you know, what they call violent extremist organizations, all of these different groups are using AI in novel and unexpected ways to mobilize, to recruit, to message, to commit cybercrime, to raise funds. And when it comes to the sort of non-conventional warfare applications, this is really problematic. And when it comes to what we call, you know, irregular warfare, which of course is regular in terms of being the dominant mode of warfare that we typically see, it really comes down to two ways, sort of, that I think the U.S. should be concerned about. And one is proxy warfare. Gray zone warfare, right? Warfare that takes place sort of below the threshold of traditional conflict. And so here, thinking about things like electoral interference, disinformation, right? Those types of activities. But on the more kinetic side, the actual provision of different types of material aid and technologies to non-state actors, right? And in doing so, as I said, the U.S. needs to be particularly aware of this because, you know, I was reading about, thinking about the surprise that Soviet helicopter pilots faced when the Afghani Mujahideen first had Stinger missiles, right? And so the U.S. needs to avoid that type of strategic surprise. Shifting a little bit to the other side, proxy warfare and then insurgency, counterinsurgency, you know, for the last few decades, counterinsurgency around the world is premised on two issues, the information and the identification problem, right? And in doing so, it's trying to work with populations, right, to try to provide enough security and protection to elicit that information, right? Who are the rebels? Who are the insurgents? AI kind of changes that equation, or at least has the potential to change that equation in that, you know, with ubiquitous surveillance, with ubiquitous cameras, you don't really need to solve that problem. And so what does that mean, you know, for doctrine and for how the U.S. wages these types of wars? I'll kind of leave those topics out there for Q&A, but the last thing I also want to say, again, this idea about strategic surprise. You know, Henry Ford said, if I asked the average person what they wanted, they'd say, I want a faster horse. And so I think one of the things that we should be careful of is that in many ways, how actors are pursuing AI, it's very much using it to enhance or amplify existing systems, right? It's making a faster horse. It's using the technology of tomorrow with the tactics of today. And I think what we really need to be concerned about are those actors who think really creatively and novelly about how you can use that technology of tomorrow with the tactics of tomorrow as well. So I'll just pause there.
Got any ideas that we should be looking out for?
No, but I thought hard for that because I was trying to get ahead of any questions. But I think that's where the interaction, that's what battles are, right? Adaptation and the back and forth, the dialectic between armed groups. Again, even some of the things right now that for example, what Russia is trying to do to try to mitigate against some of Ukrainian AI. And so this article that came out very recently about trying to spoof some of the drones that are searching, right? These drones that are sent out and looking for particular targets, and in this case, looking for airplanes, and the Russians putting truck tires on the airplanes as a way to spoof the sensing capabilities or painting silhouettes of planes on the tarmacs. So again, it's all part of that kind of iterative aspect of combat.
And this highlights something that I think people often miss, which is that because ChatGPT speaks so much like we do, we assume that it thinks like we do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these things don't think like we do at all. And they therefore fail in surprising ways. So the story that Professor Dennis is talking about, the Ukrainians have been, I think they're some kind of cruise missiles that have mm-hmm. some kind of optical seeker device. Mm-hmm. So they are looking, they're using algorithms that have been trained on images from above of Russian bombers in this case. And so they know what it looks like from above, and when they see it, they go to it. This is better than GPS, because if they move the planes around and so forth, you're not just going to bomb into mm-hmm. a GPS coordinate on the runway. Well, the AI can be fooled, apparently, by placing a bunch of tires on top of the airplane such that it looks ever so slightly different mm-hmm. to us, but fundamentally different to the algorithm that's supposed to classify something as an airplane or not airplane. Mm-hmm. And so the questions are, what other anomalous ways are these things going to fail? Our adversaries presumably are looking for the ways that our systems are going to fail to try to anticipate those. And of course, we are trying to red team for those things to fail-proof our systems against the countermeasures that we think our adversaries are developing. Does anyone have any thoughts on this cat and mouse game that's going to happen and how we do this effectively when so much of this is opaque?
I'll just add one thing really quickly on the GPS side. Like that, one of the things that is really unique about this moment in time is leveraging the battle labs, both in Israel and in Ukraine. And Ukraine in particular, that seeker, you know, part of that is now using visual positioning, because if you went to, I think it's gpsjam.org, like you will see that there are major swaths of Europe that you cannot use GPS. And it's forced, I think, even the defense industrial base in the US to go back and say, we need to rethink the way we're solving some of these core problems. And that's because we sent over a bunch of capability that didn't work. We said, hey, Ukrainians, we want to help. And then we had a bunch of platforms that didn't necessarily stand up to the battle lab that was Ukraine.
Do you want to give a few examples? I'm happy to, but...
Please.
Okay, well, there were the GPS-guided artillery rounds that were a miracle weapon for a week, but then stopped working after GPS guidance was disrupted. The HIMARS, I think some of those rockets were also GPS-guided and stopped working as well. Are there any others?
There are a few. I wasn't going to name the names of the companies. There are a bunch of drone companies that are doing sort of class one, class two, some of the smaller drones that couldn't fly in a GPS-denied environment. I think the other piece that Adam highlights is just how quickly the pace of change, frankly. Every 2 weeks, you're going through a full product management cycle. So a big part of my background is startups. I've led product teams. I've worked really closely with engineering teams. I mean, that's a big part of how when we go to war with a near-peer adversary, which I hope never happens, but if we do, we need to be willing and ready for that pace of change. And part of that is taking, you know, product management principles from the startup sector and trying to apply it to a whole host of government organizations as well.
Just on that, I mean, a few other aspects, you know, exactly to this last part, I mean, thinking about startups versus the Department of Defense and different acquisitions and the different timelines. Chris Miller, the author of Chip Wars, came, stood on this stage about a year ago and talked about just, you know, the life cycle of a new fighter jet, for example, right? And those things are made on multi-year timelines, but software is updating so fast. And so how can you sort of get ahead of that? The other side, I think, you know, I mentioned some of the things that we should be cautious of. You know, this idea that AI is going to automatically speed up decision making, right? And in some instances it may, but in some instances it may actually slow it down as well. You know, there are famous examples of Julius Caesar getting, you know, dozens of reports being saying like, I'm overwhelmed, right? They're contradictory and I don't know what to do. That dimension of what AI is able to generate, plus a sort of the natural kind of tendency of decision makers to want more information, could actually result in a process that is slowed down. And the other thing, just thinking about too, like the institutional organizational inefficiencies that could emerge when you have, like because of this, right, you're talking about things need to be highly dispersed and highly decentralized. Well, when you have AI that's able to sort of allow senior, you know, operational decision makers the ability to peek down, you know, at a micro level into an individual unit or soldier, it can engender micromanagement, right, in a way that we've never seen before, which creates, again, all sorts of inefficiencies.
Just one point. I think we have seen it, having spent some time in Iraq and Afghanistan at the end of GWAT, because we had ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance coverage to the extent that we did, you could sort of watch operations in a tactical operations center or a joint operations center in a way that you couldn't at the beginning. And so my fear would be, does that command and control, to your point exactly, continue to get tighter with some of the AI centralization we could end up seeing?
This harks back to the famous young adult novel Ender's Game, where it turns out, spoiler alert, you all seem old enough that I can say this, that one young man who thinks he's been playing a video game all this time has actually been commanding a galactic battle from his operating station. That's not so far-fetched when you talk about swarms of swarms, that one person can increasingly be responsible for issuing commands to huge, vast quantities of autonomous systems that are going to coordinate all the rest of the subplanning themselves. Professor Dennis, I wanted to drill in on something that you said and flip it into a question for Colonel Ford. You talked about the speed of the product cycle. you go from a fighter jet that spends 10 years on the drawing board and then flies for 40 years to software that's updating constantly. And hopefully the tire example illustrates this. If you're Ukraine and you're using that Seeker, it's obsolete. Once those tires go on, it needs to immediately update. And the faster that cycle is, the more likely you are to win. So Colonel Ford, we talked about checking these things, checking the thinking that they're doing before they go out the door to make sure that they're going to act ethically, to make sure that they're going to act to do the right thing. If we're updating the software, which we all agree at this point is going to be the critical piece of the system, we're updating the software constantly. We're letting it train itself in response to what it's seeing out on the battlefield. And the adversary knows this and is trying to perhaps poison our training by giving false signals. How can we ensure that these systems are going to be ethical as the training becomes so fast and the iterative development of its cognition becomes perhaps too fast and too opaque for humans to audit?
That's a great question, of course. And maybe even a harder question would be, what if it's adapting itself, right? What if it's learning in situ in the environment and we're not managing the training, which is a whole other issue. It's a very challenging question, and I think it actually brings up several different things. In the U.S. military and most Western militaries, we do weapons reviews of all weapons before they are fielded to the forces. We do it out of a sense of just not obligation or legal compulsion, but we just do it. Other countries believe it to be a matter of international law, but neither here nor there. We review all of our weapons. We review changes to weapons. And so our system, as it exists right now, wouldn't allow or account for those sort of super dynamic changes that are occurring constantly. The second issue it raises is whether or not the contracting and acquisition system of the U.S. Department of Defense can handle rapid changes in technology, and Morgan could speak to that better than I could, but the short answer is no, right now it cannot. So there's a pretty fundamental question with respect to that. You mentioned the tires, and there's two more comments I wanted to make. And the tires, that's an illustrative example of, an emergent behavior that wasn't expected, which brings up questions as to whether or not we can test the things rigorously enough in realistic environments so as to have some level of predictability with respect to that thing being fielded. The challenge, of course, is replicating those environments. And the second challenge is, and I'll defer to computer scientists or engineers that could talk to this better than I could, but for the most part, we don't understand oftentimes why the device is doing what it's doing. And so there's a challenge with respect to that. Like, it's doing something strange, and we don't understand why it's doing the strange thing. This is the old cone on top of the autonomous cars in Austin a couple years ago. This looked crazy with a safety cone. And then the last comment I'll make is with respect to the pace of change and kind of how things are moving and as quickly as they are moving. It's this hyperkinetic kind of cat and mouse game of technologies going back and forth. But as an Army institution that's looking towards the future of conflict, we recognize that's happening daily or weekly or biweekly, however often it's refreshing. But there's some kind of broader systematic changes in how warfare is being conducted. I would defer to you to talk to that. But I'll say this. So our Army warfighting concept for 1982 to 2018 was a concept called air-land battle. So 82 roughly to 18, one warfighting concept. In 2018, precipitated by different conflicts we were seeing, we changed in what we were anticipating seeing in the future. We changed our warfighting concept within the U.S. Army to something called multi-domain operations in 2018. Today, we are working on a new warfighting concept because the changes we're seeing in Nagorno-Karabakh and Ukraine and Gaza and different places like that, the fundamental shift in the way warfare is conducted and the way we anticipate it being conducted in the future.
Just to explain that reference to Nagorno-Karabakh, because this is one of my favorite topics as well. This was the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, where about a year ago now, this is a long simmering territorial dispute, an Armenian enclave inside of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan took advantage of the distraction and chaos caused by the war in Ukraine. It was more than a year, but took advantage of the distraction and chaos caused by the war in Ukraine, Russia's distraction, Russia having been a longtime protector of Armenia, and basically moved in and with the help of drones operated by Turkey and supplied by Turkey, basically decimated the Armenian defenders and took it over. And at the time, this was rightly taken as a powerful signal that if you have armed drones and the other side doesn't, you are probably going to win in a conflict between otherwise equal forces. Well, Ukraine used the same Turkish drones called Bayraktars, you may have heard of them, very effectively for the first couple months of the Ukraine war, and everyone said, huzzah, this proves that this is the future of war. And then Russia rolled in air defenses that effectively neutralized them, and you haven't heard anything about them since. So that illustrates the speed at which these people's conceptions of what the future is changing. I want to ask a question to Morgan here, and this is about this review process. We're never going to field anything unless we've reviewed it and tested it because we're so wonderful, we're so ethical, we're so careful, which is great. We want to be careful, we want to be ethical. Is that going to work if we get into a conflict with, you know, God forbid, a peer adversary like China? Or are we going to have to let it rip and be more aggressive in how fast we update our software, for example?
Well, I think, so I would say two things. First, on the, in a lot of cases where we're using AI, and check me on this because you're definitely in DoD more often than I am. We have unbelievable technical talent across the entire force, and we're starting to roll out AI tools that aren't like a software. It's not COTS, it's government. COTS, commercial off the shelf versus government off the shelf, I guess. And so commercial off the shelf, it totally makes the way that we procure means that it goes through a lengthy review. We're starting to roll out through Microsoft and other key partners across the DoD tools to the warfighter that say, here's AI and you can play with it in certain constraints to solve certain problems. So it's relevant to Adam's question because you'll have a whole bunch of warfighters in these cases who are trying to solve a really critical problem and trying to solve it quickly, and they've got a lot of tools at their disposal that it is not necessarily going to go to Army Futures Command for review. So that's part number one, if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it actually brings up maybe a related point, and I don't want to get off topic from your query, and that is kind of, we have a lot of folks in uniform, and by the way, I am in uniform, but this is not the official DoD position that I'm articulating up here today. But how do you harness innovation, but maintain standards, right? I mean, and it gets back to your point, Adam, like, you know, we're going to have a kind of a fundamentally different way and different conflict than we have seen in generations. And on one hand, it demands innovation, it demands speed of relevance, it demands constant and dynamic changes. But at the same time, at the end of the day, we're military and we need a certain amount of standardization across the force. So it's very difficult to have one unit doing one thing with a given drone and a second identical unit, you know, doing something different with a different type of drone. We have to have interoperability. One of the kind of principal, one of General Rainey, my commanding general's principal objectives is working on what the Army's referring to now is next generation combat and communication, so next gen C2. And the idea is that we need to get better at simply communicating with one another across echelons because we just don't do it very well. And again, in a large scale combat operation against a near peer, we have to have the ability to communicate at echelon and across battle spaces and between services and between countries as well. So how do you innovate, but how do you maintain some standardization at the same time? It's a challenging.
This raises an interesting question about what is standard. So let's say you have a drone, and we've used the jargon software defined a lot. Let's just take an example of a drone. You have a drone, it flies the same way, it has the same payload, but you can code into it at your forward base and in fact interact with it using a natural language interface and tell it to train itself differently, to adapt you want it to adapt a certain way to the tactical environment. Hey, I want you to develop a program for working with three of your drone comrades to strike at that Russian fire base over there. Think about it, develop that plan of operations, brief me on it, and then execute it at 0700. Is that really the same thing as the person 100 kilometers away at a different firebase is using, even though it's the same physical drone, the same physical payload, but the brains are now going to work in a completely novel and different way?
Morgan?
I actually think that's a beautiful thing. Like, I think that's okay in particular contexts. Back to your question on, like, in that moment when you need to rapidly iterate, I think it's fine. I think to the extent that there can be a standard, you know, even having like a standard set of languages where people are coding in the same language on their drone, like we don't have that today. So everybody just uses whatever they feel most comfortable with, and that makes it really challenging if you're gonna, you know, there's a reason why we all sort of shoot the same ammo round because it's interoperable. And so the interoperability is really critical. What are the standards on the sort of AI programming language side? Just one final point to wrap your last question on are we going to be able to kind of keep up with the pace of change iteration on the software side? I think we've been sort of forced into it, and again, I'd open it up to the rest of the panel for more of the legal perspective on it. But from a software side, there's no such thing as like version 9, version 10. Like, you bought version 9, which means I'm going to upcharge you for version 10. Like, you don't throw software off the back of a train now and like hope that your customer is satisfied with what it was, you know, 2 years ago when they originally bought it, because you're in option year number 3 with the government. Now, the expectation for software is that it is constantly updating and it is capable of doing that 2-week cycle if it has to do that 2-week cycle. And so I do think we can keep up, because there is this expectation in modern software as it relates to every other enterprise in the country, in the commercial domain, the same expectation is starting to come, I think, on the government side as well.
Let's close out our discussion, and audience, get ready, please, because we're coming to you next with a bit of discussion about the volume of data. I don't think we've talked about that enough, perhaps. When I look at the baseline assumptions that for me are driving AI adoption in national security, we talked about speed of decisions. We talked about being cut off from things like GPS. We've talked a bit about the competitive dynamics of your adversary doing this, so you're going to have to keep up. But we haven't talked a lot. You mentioned it briefly, Morgan, the volume of data, the fact that there's so many data streams coming in. A human being simply cannot sit there with an Excel spreadsheet and process all of them. You need artificial intelligence to make sense of this. Professor Dennis, you talked about a couple examples, one of them being Israel, one being Ukraine, using this to make sense of the vast volume of data coming from sensors, coming from visual imagery, probably SIGINT and others, which is signals intelligence, so collecting on people's cell phones and things like that, and using it to rack and stack priorities or targets, or at least identify people. Morgan, perhaps you can talk about this in the domestic realm, which is a very sensitive one. Students in my course, I think we have a couple here, surveillance, liberty, and privacy, know how very sensitive this is. There's all kinds of publicly available data, commercially available data that the government can buy from private actors, from ad tech companies. Always say no when they ask to track your location unless there's a really good reason for it. What rules apply to that data? Why is it useful, and why is AI important to making sense of it?
I think AI, the rules obviously vary depending on what context you sit in. One of the things that I loved about being at the New York City Police Department is I sat in a section that was literally surrounded by lawyers. So if you had a question...
Most people wouldn't love that, but I appreciate it. We'll take it. We'll take it.
I'm in good company on this panel. So a couple different things I would say on the open source data side. When I first got to Dataminr, which is a company that does event detection in real time, very focused on, you know, looking across the open internet and figuring out what is the, you know, good, bad, ugly thing that is happening this moment in a given place. And it's a whole variety of, you know, the scale is really different. So you can get something that is super tactical. I'm driving in Jordan in a convoy and there's a roadblock. I can divert my convoy, for example, to something that is much more strategic in nature. From an open source perspective, from a Dataminr perspective, one of the things we were always conscious of, particularly because it was critical to our law enforcement customers, was always following terms of service. So for a lot of the social media companies, they have terms of service. We followed them, again, because you needed to go make a case in court, and that data needed to be able to hold up, particularly if it was the tip or cue into a particular case. So I think that's one piece. Another piece where AI in particular can be super valuable is just from a law enforcement standpoint, there's just the reams of the the data scale problem is tremendous. And I think it goes back to some of the things, and Adam knows this better than most, it goes back to some of the siloing that we had in law enforcement from a data perspective and local versus state versus federal. So how can AI sort of support on the OSINT front? How can AI support on the law enforcement front? I think there
Can you define OSINT in case a few people haven't got it? Yeah. And also maybe explain what kinds of data streams are coming into these agencies?
Sure. So on the law enforcement, so OSINT, open source intelligence. Adam had talked a little bit about SIGINT. We use that less in the domestic law enforcement domain. But open source intel is using publicly available information, things that people post about themselves. It goes back to Adam's point on, like, don't hit yes about sharing your personal information, because we're all constantly leaking data. Like, my phone is under this chair. Like, there are many, many, many companies that know that I am sitting here right now. But one of the things that's really interesting about law enforcement is you've got data coming from record management systems. So those are records that have been generated for the better part of the last 50 years. In some cases, at least at NYPD, we keep records for a long time. Called detail records. So those are things where you had a subpoena to a cell phone carrier and you got back information about a cell phone. I mentioned call detail records because AI can be really helpful there. Increasingly, there are places from a district attorney perspective where there are things that shouldn't come back in those call detail records, where you can actually use AI to strip out anything that came back in a CDR that is not relevant to your particular case, which cities are starting to get much more focused on. Similar to if you had a search warrant for a house and you were searching for a long gun, for example, you can only look in places where that long gun could be located. So there are a lot of ways you can use AI actually to be very protective of privacy and civil liberties. I think the other thing that's really interesting is we bring all of this data together because we need to make sense of it in some way. So we need to be able to ask and answer questions. I have a start point on a particular investigation. That start point may be a name, it may be an address, it may be a license plate. You need to start somewhere, but how you follow that rabbit hole of what does my investigation start to look like, you want to do it in a way that is taking privacy and civil liberties in mind. And just one final point on where AI can be super valuable here, you can actually use AI to then run it against like an audit log of everything that I've looked at, everything I have done. Do I have a reason to be looking at a record from a particular person? And if not, like, that should let my supervisor know. There's a whole bunch of ways you can use AI, both for accountability. We're using it a lot for body-worn camera information as well. So I think it can be really helpful in law enforcement. Hope that helps.
So for example, hey Siri, go through 20,000 hours of body camera footage and find me examples where officers spoke inappropriately to the people they were interacting with. Okay, obviously you're not going to start a case on the basis of the findings, but you're going to look and check. And with these natural language models, as opposed to deterministic computing, it can use some judgment about what might be inappropriate. And if you've been following this closely, you can see that these things are gaining a surprising capability for flexible linguistic thinking, for example. Or another example, hey, go through all the queries that Austin police officers ran through the license plate reader database in the last year and see if you can find anything that looks like someone checking on his ex-wife. I mean, these are potentially very protective, and you may not have the human workforce available to do those very labor-intensive, drudgery-like tasks otherwise. Let's turn it over to, Professor Dennis, and then we're going to go to the audience.
One last thing to kind of pull on one of the threads. You know, in some quarters, so much of the conversation with this idea about, you know, the reams of data, it's about collecting it, it's about storing it, it's about managing it, it's about identifying trends. But it's also critically important to separate kind of the signal from the noise. And just thinking about, again, what I spoke about, you know, almost a year ago, right? Gaza, one of the most heavily surveilled places on Earth, surprised Israel. Ukraine, a few months ago, surprised Russia, right, with their incursion into Kursk. So again, it's a part of the story as well.
I'm actually threatened to ask you a question about my paper coming up in your class and just getting the answers now. But I'll skip that, and I'll ask a question on morality. You discussed legal and you discussed ethical, but the morality of utilizing drones and drone warfare, especially when the human is out of the loop, are we at all concerned that this becomes more like a Sunday afternoon football game where we're conducting warfare and warfare becomes a more convenient lever than it is currently because we don't really have flesh in the game anymore?
I mean, I'm happy to take that one. And I think in certain aspects of it, I don't have any special competence and everyone can consult their own intuitions. And Jeffrey has deep military experience and so brings more relevant intuition to this question than most of us do. I will say, I think we have to think of it in a broader context. You could say the same thing about air power, and many people have, by the way. It's too clean. It's too easy. We don't have any skin in the game, so it encourages us to go on these frolics around the world and attack people without feeling ourselves personally endangered. I mean, on the other hand, U.S. power enables us to deter people who want to do very bad things. And if you're sitting in Estonia, just to give an example, or Taiwan, very vulnerable countries that are at imminent risk of having their freedom extinguished by much more powerful and very aggressive neighbors, the fact that you could push a button and have a swarm of really nasty robot defenders swoop out at the people who are attacking you and thereby deter them from doing it in the first place seems really attractive and seems self-evidently moral to you because you and your family get to continue to live in peace and freedom. That's not an answer, it's just another thing to put in the mixer.
I'll add one thing, which is we focus so much on where tech is going right now, but if you look at Ukraine, it's sort of like a tale of two wars. You've got this unbelievable, like, rapid software cycle, but then you've got, like, dragon's teeth and trench warfare. And so it's interesting because you know, the Naval Academy is teaching celestial navigation again. Why is that? It's because we know that we are going to be GPS denied, and we don't necessarily have an answer at scale that is, you know, we're working on it. We've got a whole bunch of unbelievable companies that are working to solve these major problems. And like, if we had to, you know, hit the button tomorrow, I think if we could take Silicon Valley and put them in uniform the same way Ukraine did, I think we'd have a solution pretty quickly. But it is this interesting question on morality because I'm not sure we're quite there yet, actually, in some way. And so there's always going to be, like, I would argue that the Ukrainians feel the human impact more than they feel the technological impact.
I would just add that I think in some cases there may be a moral imperative to use these devices, right? You can imagine circumstances in which, you know, it is more distinct using the technology than it would be not using the technology. My ability to distinguish combatant from civilian is enhanced by using this thing, and there's a moral imperative on me to use it. I mean, the Lavender and Gospel that you mentioned are good examples. It's a very interesting system, at least as Israel has acknowledged using them, and it gets to your big data question. You've got just infinite amounts of data. And the position that Israel and the IDF has taken is this makes it more distinct. It allows us to distinguish combatants from non-combatants more readily than we would if we were just going through it piece by piece, item by item. So there's another aspect to it.
This conversation, this question just reminds me of what I began by saying is that when people looked at the future of warfare, many thought AI would be particularly consequential. And most of our conversation is about how AI is changing the character of warfare. But if you read your Clausewitz, and what I'm about to say is very heretical, you know, Clausewitz says the nature of war never changes. It changes, right? It's human, it's violent. But AI could change that, right? Where it's not human, it's algorithmic. Maybe it's violent in a way that we don't typically associate as being violent. And so, again, if we want to have these conversations about the broader context of AI in conflict, AI, what are the challenges for national security? That's another way to think about it.
So thank you for the panel. It's been so great, so many topics. You mentioned the concept of strategic surprise, and I've heard the axiom that we're always training to fight the last war, but hopefully I know we're not. But AI is so good at analyzing the known unknowns, right, and finding the signal in the communications or the satellite pictures. How good is it at finding those unknown unknowns, the threats that we haven't even conceived of yet? You know, somebody driving a ship into a vulnerable bridge, or this or that. And how can we in the corporate world make it better so that we can come up with better counters in the cat and mouse game for the threats we haven't faced yet?
I'll start with one anecdote from Dataminr. Part of what made that company so successful is before AI was good enough, we actually labeled for about a decade unknown unknowns as they were like breaking news events effectively. So I think there are a lot of different ways. I still think we have a long way to go on the unknown unknowns part, which is part of why you have a human on the loop, because you're certainly going to have a ton of moments when the tech does not recognize what is happening. But to the extent that we can leverage what is known and what has been labeled, and we can bring it together in a way that makes sense, and in a way that sort of protects the provenance of where that data came from, particularly if it's tied to people. I think that's a really critical piece.
I'm just going to guess that this is going to be the ways in which AI is least, one of the ways in which AI is least disruptive. What do I mean by that? Well, humans already, by definition, do not see the unknown unknowns coming. And in fact, we stick to our conceptions of how things are and how they're likely to transpire. And so it prevents us from seeing the unknown unknowns coming. On the other hand, the adversary designs their moves precisely to take advantage of what they see our blind spots being. And October 7th is a great example of this. Israel had, we can assume, great SIGINT coverage of Gaza, picking up cell phone signals and so forth. They thought that they knew everything there was to know because they had all of these sources. They thought they understood what the threat was, and so they were locked into seeing things a certain way, even though there were plenty of signals warning them that could have been detected. It's just hard to see the thing that you've persuaded yourself is not going to happen. AI, which by definition works based on patterns in the past data, is going to suffer from this same deficiency foreseeably. And adversaries, as we saw with the tire scenario, are going to try to capitalize on those blind spots that they can identify and those cognitive failings that they can identify to surprise you. And so I think this cat and mouse game has always been with us and will always be with us, even with AI.
Comment on the known unknowns, because I think it ties back to something you mentioned earlier, Morgan, and that is wargaming. And so in the military, we, in the U.S. military does this, other militaries do the same. We wargame different scenarios, and they can be tabletop exercises, they can be computer simulations, they can be in the dirt with folks in the field. And we always have an opposing force or a red force that plays the enemy actor. And that person playing that enemy actor has studied their tactics and techniques and is designed to replicate what we think the adversary is going to do in a given situation. The problem is we're limited by what we think they're going to do, and we fail to kind of act with imagination. So I think this is another space where you will see AI kind of coming to a fore. You look at what it was doing with chess and Go in particular, what it was taking and making moves that were just not conceptually understood by players. So I think there's a powerful space in that. And I maybe not directly related, but something you said, Adam, made me think of this as well. Another consideration we should consider, poisoning data sets. We haven't really talked about that, spoofing data sets. It's a real risk utilizing AI in different kind of combat orientations, even in training simulations or using them to simulate an Op4. We've got to be careful about the data sets we're using. Obviously, we well-known issues with bias, but just intentional spoofing or intentional spoiling of data sets could lead to really aberrant results.
Wow. My name is Rebecca Taylor. I've been a longtime resident of Austin and a startup ecosystem person, so my question may be needing to be translated for you for this environment. But my question relates not so much to open source, but dual use. And not so much the military, but after reading Bob Gates' book on the exercise of power, I came away with a much better understanding and appreciation of the non-military sources of power that we have and that we benefit from leveraging. Have you seen much from a dual use perspective of technologies that could support the non-military as well as the military sources of power that we have that we need to leverage? And I'm thinking of examples like communications. You know, we call it misinformation and disinformation now. But any of the many examples that he gave, foreign aid, food aid, communications on the ground in Gaza, for example. I'm curious whether you're seeing much dual use that's really interesting to you.
I'll start on the dual use, but take it in a very specific sort of economic power as national security power perspective, not necessarily the broader way that Bob Gates took it. There's been a really interesting shift in the last year, and I would say oriented on reindustrialization, oriented on how do we rebuild the base to be strong for the military that we need if we were to be in conflict. And I mention that because there are positive externalities that come out of it. So things like nuclear energy. I mean, even in the last week, Microsoft announced they're restarting Three Mile Island. We've got micro reactor companies and SMR companies. And, you know, the Russians, I can't remember which country it is, and this is, I'll remember it in 5 minutes after we're off this panel. They have an SMR that is effectively powering a major African city. And so there is this portion of the economy where we are actively investing in dual-use technologies on the energy front, on the industrials front, things like, I think in the last 2 years, DPA Title III, this is the Defense Production Act, which is meant to sort of, at least in some part, rebuild the industrial base. Their appropriation went from $40 million to like $1 billion in the last couple of years to really focus in on things like energy and diversifying our energy sources and rebuilding an industrial base that we outsourced in the 80s, mostly to Asia. So I think from a dual use perspective, doesn't necessarily answer the question on more of the humanitarian soft power side, of which I think we have a super strong position, but definitely want to hone in on the fact that at least from a venture capital perspective, it's much easier actually to invest in companies that are commercial first because the DoD is such a challenging customer. So I think that's a really critical piece of the puzzle and also one that we are exporting to a lot of our friends and allies.
A very quick comment. So President Biden signed an executive order on artificial intelligence, a little over a year ago now. And it invokes the Defense Production Act, for the first time in many years, with respect to sharing data, forcing or compelling private entities to share data with respect to kind of their AI with the government in certain circumstances. So that's interesting. I'm not sure how that's playing out in industry, by the way. I haven't seen any feedback on that. But
so you've mentioned some very important strategic allies, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan. You're talking about the rapid pace of innovation, moving from the hardware-dominated military to a software-dominated military. And I'm thinking about, I grew up in Kansas City, Fort Leavenworth Command and General Staff School, and all the Allied countries would come and they'd study warfare. And anyway, in this world today, there's so much data in real time being captured, really important data, right? And Ukraine and Israel and so on. And I'm wondering how that's influencing the, you know, the military schools, like there's a lot of real-time information. So I'm just curious how that's impacting your industry, so to speak, and the allied relationships, NATO, so on.
I can hop in on that. So one thing that so natural language processing is a really, you know, AI, big broad bucket, natural language processing, one piece of it. I mention it because it's so critical to how we build partner relationships because, you know, in the Indo-Pacific in particular, partnerships are so critical. And it's really hard to read from the same sheet of music if you speak a different language, if you're reading different news, if you don't have the shared context in the same way. I think one of the things that's amazing about AI is you can actually create genuine and deep shared context with your partners. And I think we're making an effort to do that. There are also a whole bunch of companies, data miners, one piece of it, I would say Vannevar Labs is another one that's oriented principally on this is what's happening in the news of the Philippines. So it just gives you a language to speak to your counterpart in a way that used to be much more challenging.
Can I have a follow-up question for all three of you on that? Are you confident that the U.S. military is going to school on the rapid iteration that we're seeing in Ukraine, on the tactics and integration of technology in the conflict that Israel's fighting counterinsurgency in Gaza and elsewhere?
Yes.
Good answer. You get to keep your job.
Phil, is there any other answer? Yes. So I think, you know, we talk about lessons learned in the military, and my commanding general's quick to point out that it's not learned until you've kind of actually embraced and kind of effectuated what you're seeing. So it's we are definitely taking lessons that we are seeing and studying them in the current battles. That is absolutely true. Kind of in terms of bringing it in institutionally, takes years to sort of bring those lessons in. And that to turn them into doctrine, to turn them into new formations, to turn them into new weapon systems. But yeah, we're seeing it, we're embracing it. The other thing I'd mention, and this gets to both your comment and Morgan's, there is a recognition in the Army for the need for greater data literacy, to kind of put it in a very generic sort of way. The understanding of these topics, both from technicians' perspective, that is to say career fields for soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines, as a career field, like people that do this stuff for a living. We don't have that right now. We have people that dabble in it. We have people that are kind of in career adjacent fields. But there's a recognition, at least in the Army, I suspect it's across the services, that we need to get better at understanding the data from a leadership perspective, and data operations, and then also recognizing, encouraging kind of the development of fields within the military that specialize in these particular skill sets.
I think I think it depends on sort of the mission and individual leadership. I used to teach Green Berets at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School, and Army Special Operations Forces are really embracing this and making schoolhouse changes. I guess the other side of it is just, you know, I would hope, yes, absolutely, all of the lessons learned, and there's all of these different efforts to try to, you know, understand what happened in recent warfare. But I'm always reminded of, you know, that quip, like, she who forgets the past is condemned to repeat it, but the other side is that she who remembers the past commits the opposite mistake. And so I'm just cautious that, you know, we need some humility in what we're learning, and being sure that the lessons that we learn aren't conveniently supporting things that we're already doing, right? So an objective analysis of what we're seeing and why it matters.
I would just add, it's really hard to learn the lessons that I think at least we've been talking about today. There are ways that it's showing up. So you'll start seeing more and more in like DIU, the Defense Innovation Unit, when they put out like a call for submissions from private sector companies, you're starting to now see things like must be able to fly in GPS denied environment, must be able to fly in an electromagnetic contested environment. Like you're starting to see the things that we have watched fail over and over again in places like Ukraine. But it's really tough to learn the doctrinal lessons because you can't, we're, in these conflicts, we're not sitting shoulder to shoulder and doing the advise-assist in the same way that we maybe were for the last 20 years, not the last 20 years, but you know, the 20 years where advise-assist was a really key component of our strategy. We have to do it from afar, and that's okay, but how you learn those lessons and articulate them and share them with the force is different. And we, at least from my seat, I haven't necessarily seen that in the way I would want to.
What steps are being taken to dial it down? So for instance, if you have a like the nuclear, at some point the nations got together and say they stopped that, or they stopped the escalation of that. So from this perspective, what steps are being taken to dial it down? Because you might imagine there'd be a continuing escalation of...
Right, so I think that's directed at the idea of arms control. Can countries agree to limit themselves? I'm skeptical about that can work, but there are some discussions happening. Chris, do you want to address that?
Yeah, so I, since I think 2012, within the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, it's a UN-administered treaty that has several parts and administers treaty restrictions on landmines and booby traps and some other things. Within that context, the international community has been looking at this issue about how to regulate, or whether we should even regulate autonomous weapons in conflict. And so it's been going on for a number of years. Really, again, as I mentioned earlier, it's a very glacial process. There are very, very strong opinions. You can imagine kind of how people fall out from a state perspective. But last I checked, there was something on the order of 80 or 90 countries that would that have publicly endorsed preemptively banning any sort of autonomous weapons in armed conflict. Other countries have been more kind of cautious about it because of the reasons I mentioned earlier. That is to say, there might be some net positive humanitarian benefits from using certain systems in conflict. So there's a lot of divergent interests and kind of perspectives for the nation state.
Just add my 2 cents, which will literally only be 2 seconds here. If China's getting it, we're probably going to have to get it. And we will, on that optimistic note, we will have to close. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists tonight.
For a full recap of policy leadership in the age of AI, including more panel audio, coverage from our exclusive keynote conversation with Dr. Alondra Nelson on AI and policymaking, and photos from the events, go to the news section on our website, lbj.utexas.edu. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at the LBJ School. This is Policy on Purpose. Thank you for listening.